Well, first, airport delays and cancelled flights are still making headlines this morning. This week, the government decided to put the army on standby to help with the backlog of passengers. We're joined now by a man who's had a long career in the Irish Army, including the elite Army Rangers Wing. After leaving, he worked in Afghanistan, among other places. He now runs Core Skills, providing training for businesses. You'll also know Ray Goggins from RTE's Special Forces Ultimate Hell Week on television. Ray, you're very welcome to the programme. Can I start by asking you what you make of the idea of calling in the army to Dublin Airport to help alleviate the congestion?
Yeah, I'd be against it, to be honest, because the army is designed for particular roles. Don't get me wrong, like aid to civil power events for like flooding and fire strikes in the past, bin strikes where they had to help the kind of local population, which is fine. But this, like, you know, Dublin Airport Authority are a profit-making organisation. You know, it's their lack of foresight that has them in the position they're in now. Like, I know there's a lot of variables and the way things, you know, recruitment and keeping people in jobs and so on and so forth. But, like, I just think it's a knee-jerk reaction from the government. And for me, it shows the government's kind of, you know, I'd almost say contempt for what the army do and lack of respect for what the army do.
But this aid to civil power, you know, if it helps people and there's a sort of a wider economic benefit from having the airport in the capital city functioning properly, and then also as well, irrespective of whatever jobs that they might be asked to do there, and there are a lot of different jobs they could do which would free up staff elsewhere, they do have that security clearance, which they do. Is
and
a
like,
problem.
Don't get me wrong, you know, on the smaller scale of it, like you have certain elements of the military, like the military police, for example, is a job that they could, you know, support in this role, maybe some other logistics groups to back up, but not just putting in like ground troops just to have bodies because they haven't or didn't recruit the right people at the right time.
Do you think it's demeaning?
I do, be honest, I do. And I think it just shows the way that the government sees the military as like, they don't know what to do with the military. They still don't. Nobody does.
What about the war in Ukraine? The consensus seems to be that it's going to go on for a long time. One of the difficulties for Ukraine is that President Zelensky said recently, I think he was saying that there were 150 Ukrainian soldiers a day being killed. If in the long term it's a war that Ukraine cannot win, they may well end up losing a chunk of their territory.
Yeah, like,
deciding when to do that is a very, very tough choice to make, isn't it, with people losing their lives?
I guess the hope they had at the start, I'd imagine, is like they could hold the Russians off long enough that maybe other assets would be brought to bear, you know, whether it's political gestures or whatever else, or ammunition or more weapons or support. But like, you know, the powers that be, NATO and so on, have shown they won't get engaged in a combat in Europe, which they can't. Like, what'll that lead to? So I think they will, it's a war of attrition. And I think the Russians will just outmuscle the Ukrainians in the end because they just have more assets. They just have more power. They have a lot more people. And that's what wins wars at the end of the day. Like,
you were in Afghanistan. You'd already left the army at that stage. You were working in protection for various people in Afghanistan during that conflict. What was that like?
Yeah, it's a beautiful country. Like, even flying in over the Hindu Kush and looking at the, you know, the mountainous region of it, and it's a beautiful place. Like, it's such a beautiful place. So I was embedded with a telecommunications company and banks. So we looked after, you know, the logistics of their security, everything from like securing telecommunications masts in Kandahar to like, you know, phone shops in Kabul. So all that went with that. So we did a lot of boots on the ground from searchers and all kinds of people. So all the people I work with were Afghan. They're very harsh people. They're tough. Obviously, they've been in a state of war for probably centuries at this stage. But they're very kind of varied. There's so many different cultures there and languages. They're just great people.
Were you ever close to some bombs going off?
Yeah, unfortunately in Afghanistan, you're always close to bombs going off. There's probably 9-10 attacks in Kabul a week. I was involved in two in particular, which were pretty kind of horrendous. One, I wasn't actually on site, but I was on the way to the site, which was the largest truck bomb ever in Afghanistan. It was a 7-ton, like a cement mixer full of explosives, targeting the German embassy. But our main employer, head office, was across the street. So we lost like 32 people killed and like 180 injured. Like, in total, there was 150 killed and thousands injured. Like, a bomb that big, like, it broke glass like 5 kilometres away. Like, there's no word to describe the carnage of something like that. Like, it knocked whole buildings, you know. It was like, we were digging people out and stuff for weeks after it. You know, it was horrendous. So that was probably one of the biggest ones I was in.
Do you carry that with you?
Yeah, what I carry about it is the fact that I wasn't able to affect it at the time. Like, I really struggled with it after that. I wasn't there to help immediately. I arrived a few minutes later, and you know, that's after the fact for me. And I always found with some of my colleagues the same, you know, we struggled with that side of it. Whereas a little while later in 2019, I was involved in another explosion that targeted where I lived, but I was actually in the blast. I got blown into my room with it, but I was able to affect it straight away. So within 10 seconds, I was up with my kit on and I was out there effectively trying to protect people. That was my job. So I found even with that, even though we had casualties and people killed in that one, I found it easier to deal with after the fact because I felt I was more effective about it.
Would you ever get flashbacks to what you saw in the aftermath of the
storms? Do I get flashbacks? I don't suffer from, you know, I don't have PTSD or anything like that. I don't think anyway. Like, I find for me, like, I deal with it. And what I do, I have a cognitive approach to something. If you have like a trauma or something that you're dealing with, like, you know, people have thoughts of it and they try and block it out. What I do is like watching a TV show. If you tape something and you watch little bits of it, you're watching it for weeks. If you watch it in one go, it's done. So when I get a kind of an idea of something, I go off and I get into the whole thing methodically and I go through it in my head and then it's done. Do I get flashbacks of stuff? Sometimes a smell or a sound might bring me, just for a couple of seconds, you know, you might, okay, and then I move on. I don't suffer with it. I don't carry it every day. It doesn't affect me because anything I've done, I dealt with.
You would have known a lot of other Westerners there. Was there did you all sort of get on well? There were soldiers from America,
yeah,
soldiers from Britain?
Absolutely. So in my role, a lot of security organisations lived in an international camp where I lived. And like, there was a lot of ex-military, Americans, British, Germans. And like, soldiers are soldiers, no matter where they're from. The mindset is similar. You do make friends, you do bond with people. I worked with a great guy, Dave Orr, an Englishman from Dagenham. Gas guy, and he used to brew his own. Like, I ended up helping out in the end, wine, beers. We ended up doing stout in the end as well, which wasn't bad. Now, had a desired effect, but you have to check your site straight after.
Everyone who makes their own says it wasn't bad.
Oh,
you have
yeah.
to ask somebody.
You never say good.
You have to ask somebody who didn't make it.
Yeah.
Who was asked to drink it.
I had desired effect.
It was okay though, was it?
I survived. I have a small twitch in my eye over, but it was good. It was good.
Now, you're originally from Cork, you grew up there. What was childhood like? You were from Fairhill?
Yeah, Fairhill. So, look.
Happy memories?
Yeah, great. Like, busy. Like, loads of kids everywhere. Like, big families in Cork in those days. So, I grew up in the 70s, 80s, and the youngest of seven children in the home.
There was a long family history of the military on your father's side.
Yeah, I discovered this, I didn't know this until probably as an adult, until I actually served in the military, and more so when my own father passed away in 1998. I kind of did some research and discovered my grandfather had served in the British Army in the Great War, and his father had joined up, you know, soon after the famine back in the day and so on and so forth. So there was a bit of a lineage there that I discovered, so.
Your father, he was obviously in the Irish Army. Further generations back, they would have been in the British Army. Was that something that you were very aware of growing up, or that was talked about much in the family?
Absolutely not. It wasn't. It was like hidden history in my family anyway. My father, obviously his father had been in the British Army. My mother's side of the family would have been very kind of nationalistic, you know, and my other grandfather, he was involved in the War of Independence, you know, on the national side of it, obviously. So like, I never really got any information on my grandfather and his career in the British military until actually after my father passed away. And I said, look, I better look into this. So I had no information on him because my father never spoke about him at all. Like, you know, he never mentioned him.
Was there any military memorabilia around the house?
Obviously, no. Even though my father had served for 23 years and so on, I think it might have been a picture or two and maybe something from his overseas. But what there was, the only thing I remember seeing was there was a medal in a cupboard somewhere, and it was an old, like, really tarnished old medal. It wasn't my father's. It was actually, it said 1914-15 on it. So obviously not my father, not born then, but it was actually my grandfather's. It's called the Monstar. It was like a World War One campaign medal. And like, I used to play with it as a child, like, because the ribbon of it was this really bright colour, and you could pin it on. So I'd have it pinned on my clothes playing war and playing cowboys and Indians with my friends and so on and so forth. So like, yeah, I was running around with my grandfather's war medals.
After seeing something in a film or a Western movie or whatever.
Yeah, which I always did, like, you know, again.
You were into Westerns, right?
I got that from my father, I think. But like for me, as a young fella growing up, like my family were so sports driven and still are. All my siblings, like all, you know, my sisters played soccer for Ireland, captain camogie teams for, you know, Ireland medal winners and blah, blah, blah. And my brothers are the same. For me, I wasn't so into it at that age. But what I was into was movies, and in particular matinees. So on Saturday afternoons, we'd an all black and white portable in one of the bedrooms upstairs, and that's where I found myself trying to, you know, bend the aerial around to get the signal. And on RT2, whatever, there might be a matinee. And for me, it was usually the likes of, you know, like John Wayne in particular, I'm a huge fan of, and any kind of Western. But like, you know, the likes of, you know, Robert Mitchum, like Humphrey Bogart, you know, anyone, Gary Cooper. I just love those sort of movies.
Good guys, bad guys, and a bit of a shootout.
Absolutely. And look, and do you know what? That's my life then. You describe my life accurately since.
Were there any photographs of family around that showed the military history?
There was. And as I got a bit more aware, like, you know, like we had a family holiday albums like everybody else. And, you know, those old kind of 1970s style ones, you know, that we all had. But it was an older kind of one from the 60s I discovered. It was some from my father. There was a few black and white pictures of my father in the likes of the Congo and Cyprus. But it was a particular picture I was always drawn to. It was a picture of my father in this kind of like US World War II American helmet, style helmet, like in the jungle in the Congo with a chimpanzee, with a monkey in his arms, like, you know, looking at the picture. So that's one story he did tell me, how it was actually a pet monkey they had in their company. So this monkey like lived in their company headquarters and in a little cage or room or something. And even now and again, the monkey got a bottle of beer off the lads every now and again to keep him in good form. So, yeah, so there you go.
Joining the army for you then, was that always on the cards?
Yeah, there was nothing else for me, only that. It's all I talked about and thought of as a child. Not because of my father. I think it was just in me. Like I never realised why until later when I found out about the lineage I was part of. But, you know, I always wanted to be a soldier, and that's what I was like.
And you decided to apply to become a ranger, one of the Irish Rangers, which is the elite group within the Irish Army. How do you get into that? When you're already you know, a soldier, what's the process? You apply
Yeah, you do. So, like, they recruit from everywhere. So guys from the Navy, Air Corps and the Army can join it. The start point is what's called selection. So it's not, you don't just turn up and knock at the door and you're in. So there's a kind of a training process, which now runs for 11 months and 2 weeks. So it's a year, where you're tested and trained to become what's called an operator to get into the unit. So the failure rate is quite high. It's like 90%, you know, and thereabouts. So a lot of it is about, it's all about mindset. Like it is about, yeah, you have to be physically fit, of course. So that's kind of what you do. I applied for that. I did two courses. I failed my first one because I didn't prepare correctly for it. So that was in the early 90s as a younger soldier.
So when that happens, you're out, you're back.
Oh, you're back, you're out of the gang, yeah, that's it.
And then you apply the second time.
You go back to your own unit then and get faced at the ribbon and the slagging off the lads for a couple of months. And so I decided my reasons why I wasn't successful because, you know, I hadn't enough purpose and what I call reason why stuff, why you're doing stuff. I didn't believe in myself enough. I worried about things I couldn't control. So I undermined my own ability. And a few weeks into the course, I quit. I wasn't pushed off it. Like, if I had the right mindset, I could have kept going. So I went back then and, you know, did some career stuff, got promoted, did some more operational stuff in the likes of Lebanon. And, you know, as a junior leader, got a bit more confidence and then, you know, built myself up and went back. And the second time around, luckily enough, I got through it.
What was it like then to be in that group?
People think special forces are built on, you know, your disco muscles are eating snakes and jumping out of planes and all this stuff. But it's not. Like, it's about your vulnerability and your understanding of, like, other people will help you and other people, like, reaching out for people when you need them and understanding your limits. And that's what makes you strong. Like, it's not the individual, it's the team.
How does that get tested?
It gets tested in everything. So you're put in positions where you're constantly on the back foot. So every decision you make is pressurised. So it shows you that sometimes you can't do stuff yourself. You have to reach out. And that's not kind of trying to undermine your weakness. It's trying to show you you're more effective when you actually work with a team.
What was the Lebanon like?
Lebanon was a great experience. My first mission there was at 19 years old. So my very first task in there was what's called minesweep. So when you're kind of involved in something like that, it makes life very real very quickly. And like the first time you're engaged in gunfire, like incoming at you is a very kind of disconcerting time as well. But like the army are, you're trained well to deal with that stuff. Like, are you scared? Absolutely. Of course you are. But you just kind of get on with your task. You focus on what's immediate and what you need to do.
And what's the country like, the people there?
Beautiful. It's like, do you know, it's like, it's kind of hilly and it's like Connemara, but warmer. And but again, the people are lovely because the Irish footprint there was there since the 70s. So there was very much a cultural connection with the local population. So you're learning Arabic and you're teaching them Irish, whatever's going on. So like that bond is brilliant. And Irish troops are very good at that, because we don't bring a colonial hangover with us anywhere we go. So we take the people as we are.
And is that something that they're aware of?
Yeah, very much so. Like, especially when I worked in Afghanistan, for example, like a lot of the teams I worked with are Afghan men, like, and, you know, very proud, you know, like you have like Pashto guys and all these kind of, you know, that the Taliban are made up of mainly the tribe they come from. So they're very proud, very kind of warrior-like people. And like they have a history with the British in particular. Like they've more wars with the British than we've had, to be fair. And they kind of have that attitude still towards them. Whereas me as an Irishman, like, I always had that extra little connection with them. Because
but they would be aware of some of that.
Of course.
They would know where Ireland was.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah. They'd chat away. Like, it was one good friend I had in particular, used to love tea, Bewley's tea. So anytime I come home and leave, I'd bring him back tea.
So after the army, you went into private work, protection of executives. You were in Afghanistan. Did you do a lot of that in other countries as well?
Yeah, I worked for as a consultant protection officer for MasterCard for a while. So that was a great experience, because I was able to, I was involved in protection operations with their CEO and so on and so forth, like, who's, you know, a global operator. So I was involved in a lot of kind of high profile events, you know, like Rugby World Cup, Brit Awards, like Roland Garros, all these like fantastic locations, you know what I mean? So I was used to roughing it with the army. And I was sitting in these fantastic locations with a nice suit on and sitting in fancy cars.
Yeah, you had
cars.
To wear a suit and have an earpiece and all that.
Well, not so much earpiece, kind of hidden ones, but it was a very good
talking
experience.
Into your cufflinks.
Just like the movies, yeah, that's what it is, yeah. No, it's only Americans do that, but yeah. But
is the money good?
Yeah,
it is. How do you price a job, like going to Kabul, for example?
Yeah, well, like in the security world, like, kind of the higher the danger, usually the higher the price of what you're doing. So like there's a certain limit of danger, and like it's still like the military. The mindset is the same. It's run like the military. You're just in civilian attire in the main, and you're being paid better. That's the difference.
If you look at your experience in the army and what you learned, how do you think that's applicable to, let's say, for example, the corporate world? What are the skills or the things that you would have learned in attitude or approach that you can bring with you and impart to others?
So much. For me, when I stepped out of the military, I was still very kind of rough and coarse almost. Special forces in particular, there's a certain amount of aggression involved and so on and so forth. And, you know, being very definite and very focused. So I spent my whole career trying to be this kind of optimal special forces soldier. But I didn't realise, along with all that, I was learning all these soft skills that I didn't realise that I was picking up along the way.
You didn't find yourself sort of kicking in doors in some head office somewhere?
I tell you, came close a few times, let me tell you. Came close, but I managed to restrain myself.
In the corporate world, people talk about teamwork a lot, and we work in teams and it's all about teamwork. And you would have experienced this a lot in the army, but in a way, teamwork really only gets tested when something goes wrong. And a decision is made, it could even be a group of friends in school get in trouble, whether you protect the people who are around you or whether you shop them.
Mm.
And very often in the corporate world, they're great for talking about teamwork, but the culture is actually to shop other people.
Yeah, it is. I find in some experience, not all now, but in some organisations I've worked with and done some training with, that people very much have that. They use all the corporate jargon. They talk about all the buzzwords that they've read or heard somewhere, but they don't. You have to live it. So I find that very much is the case. Like the reality of actual team, and I mentioned the word vulnerability, like, and in corporate, people don't want to show that. They don't want to show that, okay, I got that wrong. That's actually my mistake, my bad. And I worked...
They're more likely to say that was his mistake.
And that's what happens. They start pointing at people. So you have that blame culture, which undermines any organisation. So that means then you have that them and us attitude. And like smaller groups of people will do well themselves, but the whole organisation suffers as a result.
It's a very different situation to be trained in the army to deal with stressful situations. And as you said yourself, even to, you know, to come under live fire. as opposed to trying to meet a deadline or falling short in the corporate world. They are very different.
They are, but it's the same process. Like, our body reacts to, you know, physiologically to stress, worry, fear, anger, the same way. Whether it's, you know, you've forgot to do something for a client, or you've forgot a deadline, to, like, you know, a more extreme version of what I experienced. Like, fear is fear, and like, stress is stress, and our body reacts the same way. So if you understand that and you have simple coping mechanisms to kind of tone that down a bit, when you're calm and you're composed when you're doing something in your everyday, your chances of being more effective, getting things right, you know, your behaviours, your interaction, your problem solving abilities are so much better than if you're stressed and panicked or worried. But I find, like, if you feel good about yourself physically, it helps everything else. So I do, I train kind of tipping away, but I do one particular training thing once a week in the forest where I live, where I run with a log for like 40 minutes an hour. Like, I don't do it to be a hard man. I do it because I hear the no voices in my head then are saying, what are you doing? Like, stop doing this. And I know what they sound like then, and that helps my resilience. So if something comes up in a normal day, if I'm dealing with a company or like dealing with stressful stuff in my training company, because, you know, it's all new to me, like accounts and invoice and all this stuff. So that's what I have to be resilient about.
Do the neighbours see you running with the log?
They don't. I actually have it hidden in the forest. So I drive up to the forest and I kind of take it out and off I go. I try not to see too many people. It's usually on a weekend, early morning.
Is this something that you're sort of dragging behind you with a rope
it's
and
not
a harness,
too big,
or it's up on your shoulder?
It's probably about, you know, 4 or 5 foot in length. It's about 20 kilos and it's on my shoulder, yeah. Yeah. It's not that heavy really, like, depending on how much it's rained. But like, that's my way for me, you know. It is a physical event, but that brings me into the kind of mindset then. It gets me doubting myself and stuff. And like, a little bit of pressure on you when you can do it will just helps you. Like, it means, you know, it's like any inoculation. You know what I mean? You get better than the next time and the next time.
Well, Ray Goggins, former Army Ranger and Director of Core Skills, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
My pleasure, Richard.